Welcome to the Filmtrepreneur Podcast, episode number 35.
Every great idea is on the verge of being stupid. Michel Gondry.
This is the Filmtrepreneur Podcast, where we teach you the top strategies, tactics, and growth hacks that every indie filmmaker needs to know to make money with their films. We are the podcast that puts the business back into show business. And here's your host, Alex Ferrari.
Welcome to another episode of the Filmtrepreneur Podcast. I am your humble host, Alex Ferrari.
Today's show is sponsored by Rise of the Filmtrepreneur, how to turn your independent film into a profitable business. It's harder today than ever before for independent filmmakers to make money with their films, from predatory film distributors ripping them off to huckster film aggregators who prey upon them. The odds are stacked against the indie filmmaker. The old distribution model of making money with your film is broken, and there needs to be a change. The future of independent filmmaking is the entrepreneurial filmmaker or the filmtrepreneur. In Rise of the Filmtrepreneur, I break down how to actually make money with your film projects and show you how to turn your indie film into a profitable business. With case studies examining successes and failures, this book shows you the step-by-step method to turn your passion into a profitable career. If you're making a feature film, series, or any other kind of video content, the Filmtrepreneur method will set you up for success.
The book is available in paperback, ebook, and of course, audiobook. If you want to order it, just head over to www.filmbizbook.com. That's filmbizbook.com.
Today's show is also sponsored by the Make Your Movie Bootcamp. You want to make a feature film but have no idea where to begin. I feel you because that's exactly where I was when I first got started, but I finally decided to stop talking about making a movie and go out and just do it. After working in the business for over 25 years and working with some of the biggest clients and stars in Hollywood, I decided to finally make my first micro-budget feature film that was self-distributed, sold around the world, and I even got a streaming deal from Hulu. It took me years of hard work to learn from my mistakes and to get where I am today. I want to help filmmakers break through their own fears and show them the secret sauce on how to make a profitable film. The Make Your Movie Bootcamp is a two-day intensive covering on day one, micro-budget filmmaking, and on day two, the Filmtrepreneur method, where you learn how to create revenue from your feature films. We cover everything from fleshing out your idea, the screenwriting process, finding money, crowdfunding, directing your film, post-production workflows, marketing, film deliverables, self-distribution secrets, and how not to get ripped off by predatory film distributors. The bootcamp takes place March 28th and 29th in Burbank, California, and spaces are limited, so act now. Head over to mymbootcamp.com. That's mymbootcamp.com.
Now, today's guest, I saw this movie poster. I saw this movie poster months ago at Cannes, last year actually at Cannes, and the movie poster was for a movie called Attack of the Killer Donuts, and it looked awesome. The poster was so well done. The quality, I was just absolutely shocked at how good it kind of looked. And it looked so much, it looked like it was so much fun. And I felt that these guys were absolutely knew what they were doing when they put this whole thing out. And I wanted to bring on one of the filmmakers. His name is Rafael Diaz Wagner. And he's an accomplished filmmaker who's worked on multiple films over his course of his career. And he's a Miami boy. And we've walked a lot of the same, fought in a lot of the same foxholes from back in the day when I was in Miami. So I wanted to have him on the show. I wanted to talk to him about how someone gets financing for a movie called Attack of the Killer Donuts and his whole process of how he made it and how they're marketing it, how they're selling it, and how you kind of put together a cult classic, you know, how that works. So without further ado, please enjoy my conversation with Rafael Diaz Wagner. I'd like to welcome to the show Rafael Diaz Wagner, man. Thanks for coming on the show, brother.
No problem.
We've walked a lot of the same, as I call gravel, in Miami, haven't we?
Yes, we have. We've been in the same foxholes.
Yes, we have.
The trenches.
And you told me before we got on air that you used to run the Miami Underground Film Festival.
Yes, I was the founder, and I ran the Miami Underground Film Festival for 4 years, and one of your films, Broken, mm-hmm. won a golden coconut.
Oh, golden coconut. That was awesome.
Yeah, we used to give out the golden coconuts.
That's right. And it's been a decade. So forgive me if I forgot. I remember the festival. I'm like, I had to have gone through there. I'm like, I hit every festival in Miami, especially in Florida. So I'm sure. But that's so cool. I'm so glad I won the golden coconut.
Yeah.
So, man, let's talk a little bit about how you got into this crazy business. Why do you do this and not get a real job?
Well, that's what my wife wants to know.
Exactly. You and me both, brother.
Yeah, I went to school here in Miami, Florida International University, and they didn't have a film program. And I always loved film, but, you know, we're son of immigrants. Your parents are always pushing you to be like an accountant or something steady.
Yes.
And I studied English, journalism, stuff like that. Dropped out a senior year to start my own magazine that lasted like 6 months. Then I did odd jobs for about 10 years, from working at a think tank in Washington, D.C. to selling used cars here in Miami. And then finally, I worked at – do you remember Lion Video in Miami?
No, I don't.
Lion Video was the premier DVD store in Miami. It was specialized in foreign films. And I worked there, and it was like – that was my film school. I mean, they had stuff on tape back then that still is not out on DVD today. I mean, like foreign – we had an entire wall of French films with no subtitles. It was just straight up French. And that's where I learned – you know, I always loved cinema, but that was like, whoa, another level. You know, Fassbender and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And then somehow I got back into it, and I shot a short. And then from there, I did a feature film for $20,000 in 2004 called Pork Chop and a Glass of Water.
It's a fantastic title, by the way. Fantastic title.
We went to a few film festivals, but nothing really came of it. And then from there, just, you know, struggling here and day, PAing sometimes. Mm-hmm. And then I was a production coordinator on a film for National Lampoon called The Legend of Osmus Maximus in 2008. Mm-hmm. And then the economy went down, and did some odd jobs again. I mean, I've gone in and out of the business like two or three times. Mm-hmm. And then things really started kicking, I would say, like around again in 2013. And I went 2 years back to back filming. We ended 2012, 2013 filming a movie called Shark and Saw Women's Prison Massacre.
Which I wanted to talk to a little bit. Can you please talk a little bit about Shark? Is it Shark and Saw Women's Prison Massacre? Because I saw the trailer today.
Yes.
It's quite genius. Can you please tell – it's a great cast. I'd love to – just tell us a little bit about that movie.
That film, I was looking on IMDb, and I'm good talking to people, and I thought I could get a little bit of money to make a movie. But unlike you, I didn't study directing. I can't edit, so I'm limited. I'm a writer by heart. I can write till the cows come home, and producing comes naturally. You know, it's the Miami Cuban in me. Mm-hmm. So I needed someone who was turnkey, someone who had experience. And I looked, and I found Jim Wynorski. And if you don't know who Jim Wynorski is, he is Roger Corman's most prolific director. He's made over 80 films.
Wow.
And so I cold called him, and he responded. And we talked back and forth, and he's like, you know, yeah, I do low budget. I'm like, well, we could do this and blah, blah. So I got, you know, some monies, and we decided to go to northern Florida, west of Tallahassee, an hour west, to shoot in some caves.
Ooh.
Yes.
So just for everybody who knows, west of Tallahassee is I think you've left Florida at that point.
Well, it was Central Time Zone. I didn't even know that existed.
Yeah, I was going to say you've left Florida at that point. A lot of people argue that after Orlando, you've left Florida.
Yeah. So we went there, and then he brought along his crew as turnkey. We brought in Tracy Lords. Mm-hmm. I knew Dominic Swain's boyfriend from LA. And then, you know, I was talking to him. I'm putting together this project, AFM. And he's like, oh, you should call Dominique. And I was like, come on, dude, she's not going to do this. I can't afford her. And he's like, oh, yeah, she loves stuff like this. So we called her, boom, and she was on board too. Mm-hmm. And we went over there to make this crazy little film. And I thought, this is going to be a cakewalk. This guy Wynorski's made over 80 movies. I mean, there's books on him. There's a documentary on him. Mm-hmm. And, we got there on the first day, and it's like, oh, my God, he's a freaking maniac. It was a nightmare.
Really?
It was a nightmare. I really thought I was going to get a heart attack.
What happened?
It was one of the worst experiences I've ever had. Day one, I walked off set, and when I come back, it's lunchtime and he's throwing a sandwich and firing the caterer. Now, obviously in LA, you can do that. West of Tallahassee in the middle of nowhere, you can't fire the caterer because there are none.
There's not like 50 more caterers you can call.
Yeah, he was just, you know, I don't want to talk bad about people, but I think that sometimes bravado and maverick and, oh, he's a hustler, gets people away with certain behaviors. Yeah. Like I've heard, you know, horror stories of Michael Bay. I don't know him personally, but I don't think there's an excuse for that. I mean, you know, the makeup girl cried twice. I had to, you know, talk people off a ledge. We were, you know, going over production. It was a maniac.
Wow.
You know, like
How old was he when you made that movie?
He's in his 70s. Yeah.
Yeah. I've had experiences with, and I'm not going to say older directors, but directors that have had success in their early days, and they're like in their 70s, sometimes even 80s. I've had projects, and it's very interesting.
it's
very
crazy.
Interesting. So
we got past that. And then I'm the producer on that, but then eventually we had a difference of opinion with the executive producers and him and stuff like that. And I walked away from the project. Mm-hmm. And then they went on to post-production, and they sold it, and it's distributed by Shout Factory. So I saw it in Best Buy and stuff.
Nice, nice.
And as a matter of fact, if you go to IMDb, I'm credited as the sole producer. But if you buy the DVD or rent it, my name is not in the credits. So I'll just leave it at that.
But that's the stuff they don't teach you in film school.
Exactly. And then from that experience, which was really a low point where I really did think I was going to get a heart attack. It was that bad. I felt sick. I didn't want to go to sleep at night because I didn't want to wake up the next day.
Right.
And then from that, a year later, I went to probably the best experience I've ever had in a film, and that's Attack of the Killer Donuts.
So let's talk about Attack of the Killer Donuts, because that actually is the reason I called and reached out to you. And then once we started talking, we realized that, you know, we'd known each other. We'd known each other's work, and we're from Miami and all that kind of stuff. But, dude, I was telling you when we were off air that I saw the poster for Attack of the Killer Tomatoes while it was at the Cannes Film Festival.
Donuts.
Yeah.
Donuts.
Excuse me. Yeah. Freudian slip. Attack of the Killer Donuts. And I saw this amazing poster. And I'm like, this can't be real. This can't be a real movie. And I looked it up. I'm like, holy crap, someone made this movie. This is awesome. And I actually posted it all over the place and retweeted it and everything. And everyone was like, this can't be real. Everyone's like saying, no, this is a fake. Because it looked so good. The poster looked so good that it looked like a fake movie. It didn't look like a real movie. But then I saw the trailer. I'm like, this is brilliant. So that's why I reached out to you, because I wanted to know, first of all, what brought you to make Attack of the Killer Donuts?
Well, while filming Shark and Saw, there was people involved there. And, you know, when you're on set, you're always thinking, what's the next gig? Mm-hmm. And there were people that were floating around this idea of, oh, you know, we have this idea for this movie. And I was like, I love that. And then, you know, Killer Donuts. And then I said, well, let's call it Attack of the Killer Donuts, because I'm gonna show you my hand here. And the reason it says Attack is, number one, because it starts with an A.
Of course. Yeah, yeah. Always, yeah, you know, distributors list, yeah.
Oh, yeah. I mean, when do you go – you're in a hotel room on video on demand and you start at Z? Never. You start at A. So, boom, Attack. And it has also Attack of the Killer Tomatoes. It's like it just rolls off the tongue, you know, Attack, stuff like that. So we did that. I read the script and there was a lot of potential there, but the action didn't really start until like page 45 or 50. And you just – you can't do a movie like that. Like for people that, you know, who are just listening who are not – don't know, every page in a script, every page is a minute. Mm-hmm. So you're talking about nothing happening for 45 minutes. That's just you can't do a movie like that.
In a movie called Attack of the Killer Donuts.
Exactly. Yeah. Like, I mean, I love slow cinema, but this is not slow cinema. So
this is definitely not a French New Wave film.
Exactly. Or like there's an Austrian film a few years ago, I remember, called Revenge, which is like 2.5 hours and it's so slow. And I was like, I love it. But, you know, that's not this.
Right.
This is more the Roger Corman school where – what I like to say is every 10 to 15 minutes, either something's blowing up or someone's getting blown, but something has to happen.
Yeah.
You know, you can't just sit around. So right. we tried to do a rewrite, and it was still kind of like, and like I said, my strong suit is writing. Mm-hmm. So I bought the rights and then I rewrote it. And then that's where we are now, which is what, you know, we start off and it's in a laboratory and this critter rat attacks the guy. So it's like, you know, because story-wise, we couldn't get the donuts killing early because they have to be made, which was the problem with 45 minutes. So I had to come up with some sort of action to at least hook you. And what we did is it's Uncle Luther. He's the mad professor, and he's doing the reanimation serum. Mm-hmm. And then we see him test the rat, and the rat comes to life and it attacks him. And at least it's like, okay, there's something here. It's, you know, it's kitschy, and then it gets the thing going. And then eventually he drops it into the Fryolator 3000 and the donuts come to life.
Right. That's genius.
Absolutely. And bad things happen. Yeah.
And bad things. Well, when there's killer ooze that radiates donuts, generally bad things happen. And now you also got to work with the legendary C. Thomas Howell.
Yeah.
How was C. Thomas to work with, man?
That was also, you know, one of those things where you think we'll never get somebody like him. Sure. But somebody knew somebody that knew him, and he reached out and he got it. You know, he's like, I know what this is about. It's not a Shakespeare, but it's something, you know, he's been in the business for a long time.
Well, since E.T., if not earlier.
Yeah, exactly. And he, we negotiated, we got him down to a ridiculous price that I can't say because, I mean, he won't admit to it. He's like, that's a lie. And so, so we had him for 3 to 4 days, uh-huh. and he agreed. And then, you know, he showed up and it was great. He was just like, all right, what are we doing?
So that's a really good point. You had him for about 3 or 4 days, right?
Yeah.
So that's a thing a lot of people that are listening don't understand, that when you see some of these bigger names in these kind of lower budget indie movies, they're not there for 3 or 4 weeks. They're there for a day sometimes 2 or 3. And then you just put their face on the DVD cover or on the poster to sell the movie. Is that generally the way it works?
Exactly. Yes, that's exactly how it works. And then that's a big advantage because I always get asked, you know, I'm based in Miami, even mm-hmm. though I film donuts in Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. Oh, what's the advantage? What's better? Do I move to LA? And there's good and bad in both. The advantage to Los Angeles is, you know, it's easy for me to tell C. Thomas Howell, I need you 3 days. Just drive up to this address or send a limo to get him.
Yep.
As opposed to we're shooting in Miami, I got to fly him.
Yep.
According to SAG, he can't act that day because he's flown. So mm-hmm. that's 2 days now. Then he acts. He can't fly out that day. So now it's 3 days. You know, it's a lot harder as opposed to just drive up, boom, boom, and you're done, you know?
Right, exactly. And that's one of the things when I moved from Miami and started doing projects here, being here, everyone's here as far as actors are concerned. So in this low budget kind of world, it's a lot easier. I'm like, hey, can you come out for like 4 or 5 hours today? And and just like as opposed to when I was in Miami, forget it. Like trying to get someone, you know, let's say a Danny Trejo to fly out, forget it.
Yeah, but you know, it's not gonna happen.
But if Danny's at home, he's like, yeah, I'm not doing anything on Thursday. Here's my rate. Yeah, I'll show up, and there you go. And you've got a Danny Trejo in your movie. Now we were talking off air a little bit about pay of actors and some people overpaying and underpaying. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yes, the movie we shot in 2008, National Lampoon's The Legend of Awesomus Maximus, that was a $2.2 million budget. And that had some names in it. I mean, we had Will Sasso, Ian Ziering, Rip Torn, Kristanna Loken. I mean, there were names in there. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I tell people, because I love giving advice, you know, people ask me, oh, what do you think this? And I tell them, you know, you're going to have to overpay somebody. Someone's going to get overpaid. Mm-hmm. But the flip side of that is that you're going to get some deals on somebody. I mean, I don't want to say you're going to screw somebody, but you know, it's the other side of the coin. And usually the first person to drop is the one you're going to have to overpay because nobody wants to be first.
Right.
I don't care, you know, unless you're like, you know, Woody Allen or something like that, if people trip over themselves to be in your movie, nobody wants to be first. They're going to ask you who's directing, mm-hmm. who's in it. And nobody wants to be the first guy. So you're going to have to overpay somebody, you know? Mm-hmm. And sometimes you'd be surprised some of these older stars that have more clout in the European markets mm-hmm. are willing to do certain things, you know, for prices. Like I've heard, you know, like a Malcolm McDowell give you a day for $30,000.
Oh, yeah. You know? Oh, yeah. I've heard of that too. Malcolm, you know, as long as the project, he's a little bit more picky, but yeah.
But if it's in LA, you know, it's, hey, I'll send a limo $30,000 one day. I don't care how big you are. $30,000 in one day. That's, come on.
You got to be at a certain place in your life to turn that down.
Yeah.
You got to be, exactly. I mean, as a human being, you've got to be in a certain place in your life to turn down $30,000 in a day.
Well, look at Bruce Willis and that fiasco with Expendables 3 where he turned down a mill. not for a day, but he turned down $1 million, and him and Sly got into kind of like a, you know, a hissy fit about it.
Well, Bruce is legendary now, apparently, for being being an interesting character to work with. Though he'll always be John McClane to me, and that's who I'd like to think of him as.
Yeah. Well, look, Harrison Ford was like, I'll take that million, dude. I'll be in that. You know, it's Harrison Ford. So it just depends.
Yeah, exactly. It's just – exactly. And but I've – I mean, since I've been in L.A., I've worked on, God, probably, I don't know, probably 40 features. And I've seen a lot of these guys. And I always ask the producers, like, how much did you pay for these guys? You know, I'm like – and I'm shocked sometimes at how affordable they are in the grand scope of things. You know, 10 grand here for a day, 5 grand for a day, 3 grand for a day. You know, work, you know, 10 grand for a week, you know, things like that. And you're like, really? Some of these people are, you know, household names, older, but household names. I was speaking to one actor, I won't say his name, but I was asking him specifically, and he's, if I said his name, everybody would know who he is. But I was asking him, I was like working on a set somewhere, and I'm like, you know, why do you do a lot of these, you know, kind of lower end movies? He's like, dude, I call those alimony movies. I got alimony to pay for. I got mortgage to pay for. I got to pay my bills. So that's what they're called. You know, he goes, I do them, you know, that's why I do them. So, and then some guys just like to work, like Trejo. Danny just works.
I want to emphasize that too. We don't want to make it seem like they're just mercenaries or they're down on their luck. No. In the end, they want to act. Yes. And these smaller projects are funner for them.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, if you're working on Shark and Saw. Thank you. Shark and Saw, Women's Prison Massacre.
Yeah,
you're generally you feel that you might have a good time on that movie, you know, or Attack of the Killer Donuts, probably going to be a fun set. Hopefully.
Oh yeah. Oh, it was. I had 30-year veterans tell me I haven't had this much fun in my life. As a matter of fact, I mean, I don't want to give away any of the movie, but there's
donuts and
pyrotechnics.
Yeah, donuts and their killers.
We had someone who made Don Markell. He made an 8-foot by 8-foot mock-up of the donut shop, and we blew it up. And he was actually on the team that won the Oscar for blowing up the White House in the first movie. And why did he do my movie? Because he's retired, and he's like, sure, I'll make a few bucks and I'll have fun. And he had a blast. He would get into costume and scare the makeup girls. He would like animate a rat remote controlled. He was just like this old school guy.
He was a kid having fun.
He was loving it. He was loving it. And what people don't realize is California is the desert. And we were in Acton, California, which is like 30 minutes north. Mm-hmm. And in December at night, it's cold, very cold. So he would dress up in this. He had some like Bigfoot suit. Mm-hmm. And we're in the woods shooting Attack of the Killer Donuts. And he jumps out. And even grown men like grips were like, Don, is that you? You know, stuff like that. So but it was great. I mean, there's some scenes where we literally told everybody, grab 10 donuts. And when we say action, throw them. That was, you know.
I mean, seriously, that's just fun. That's just good. That's just good times.
It really is.
That's just good
times. Like I said, I went from the worst experience to the best experience, and that was, you know, Attack of the Killer Donuts.
So let me ask you a question. How did you – because what caught my eyes – because there's a lot of movies that are made at this budget level, at this kind of genre kind of stuff, but very few are actually marketed properly. Mm-hmm. And you actually had an amazing poster that caught my eye because I saw the quality in it, and I'm going to put a link. I'm going to have a copy of the poster in the show notes, guys, so you guys can take a look at the artwork on this. I'm assuming that you, obviously with just the name, you were already thinking about marketing way before you ever shot anything.
Oh yeah, definitely. I mean, we don't have the funds. Unfortunately, when it's low budget, I mean, you throw everything at the film and then at post-production, and we had real donuts, puppet donuts, and CGI donuts. So we really put the monies on the screen, and it doesn't leave you much for publicity. And unfortunately, it's part of the equation. You know, you have to leave something for that. So I always thought, like I said, Attack starts with an A, we can get out there. And then we got our foreign distributor, and they took it to, it's been to the Berlin film market, Cannes film market, and it's going to Toronto in next week.
Nice. Now, how has it been received? And have you guys gone after the festival circuit? Have you been played in festivals?
Well, Foreign went for the markets, and then we had our world premiere July 1st at the Florida Supercom, and we won Best Film. So.
As you should. Yeah. I know the guys who run that. That's they're great. Is Terry still running that?
Yes, he is. And as a matter of fact, Now, next week, we're going to the Rome International Film Festival in Rome, Georgia. Because every time I say Rome, everybody's like, ooh
fancy.
Yeah. But something that I did is I'm very good at strategy when it comes to festivals. And everybody worships at the altar of Sundance. And I'll go out on a limb and be the crazy guy. Mm-hmm. I don't care about Sundance. Mm-hmm. I don't like Sundance. I don't like what they represent. They haven't been indie in over 20 years. Mm-hmm. And you're wasting your money because there's thousands and thousands of applicants. And it's Hollywood. It's indie Hollywood that's there. Mm-hmm. So what I did is I looked at a strategy of when is it going to be done? What months do we want to hit? And target, you know, local ones, genre ones. Like I purposely wanted for Florida SuperCon to be our first one because it's home cooking, it's Miami, and it's a Comic Con, you know. So we were actually delayed for a year. We were supposed to go last year, and we had trouble in post production and stuff like that. And it's funny because I look at my notepad, and I'm old fashioned. I write everything down, and I had my festival strategy, and it's going exactly as I planned. All I had to do was change the dates. It's, you know, Florida SuperCon, Rome International, if we can get in. You know, we wanted to get into Fantastic Fest.
Sure, sure.
But we didn't get in, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. But that would have been a big one. And then, you know, now we're going to Melbourne also in Melbourne, Florida.
Yeah, I know. By the way, anyone who's listening to this, the Melbourne International Film Festival in Florida, Terry runs that festival. They are amazing. And they treat their filmmakers like gods. It's so much fun, that festival.
I can't wait. Yeah, it's Melbourne Independent Film.
Oh, excuse me. Independent.
Yeah, because the other one's the one in Melbourne, Australia.
Yeah, right. So I got confused. Yeah, the Independent Film. They're awesome, man. Really great festival.
Which, and also, again, it's little tricks. And it like the same way Attack starts with an A. When you look at the poster now in a few months, it's going to say, you know, Florida SuperCon, best film. Rome International, Melbourne. How many people know Melbourne, Florida?
Oh, dude, I was doing that. I was doing those tricks back in the day of Broken.
Yeah.
I got into Rome. I'm like, yeah, Rome, Melbourne. I used the Melbourne. It's everyone's like, wow, you got into Australia? I'm like, yes. Yeah, it's marketing, man. It's marketing, yep. You know? Mm-hmm. You know, back in the day when I took Broken to Sundance, I literally just I didn't get in. But I walked the streets with Broken, and when I came back to on my website, I said I put the laurels up and I put Sundance, but then underneath it I put visiting.
That's good.
And people were like, "Wow, it's Sun!" And I had people write up, "Yeah, straight from Sundance." I'm like, "Well, technically, I did come straight from Sundance." You know, so these are the kind of like guerrilla techniques you have to do sometimes in marketing.
You have to. I mean, I think a lot of people that go to, like, let's say a film school, they teach you the right way, quote unquote, to do things. And if you're going to do that and play by Hollywood rules, you're going to get squashed because you can't compete with Transformers 3, man. You just can't, you know?
Nope. You can't. And you can't compete with their marketing.
Exactly.
You've got to be niche. You have to, as they say, the riches are in the niches. And it's very, very true. And as long as you understand what your movie is about, like you obviously understand your market and demographic for Attack of the Killer Donuts. Like that is a very specific niche genre. It's a niche of a niche. So it's a niche of a genre movie. So it's a kind of that kind of movie. And that's who you're selling it to, as opposed to people who make like a movie like Attack of the Killer Donuts. And they're like, why didn't I get into Sundance? I'm like, are you crazy? Like that they don't program that, guys. Like South by Southwest, it might have a shot at like the midnight, you know, movie at South by Southwest or something like that. But
well, speaking of that, we almost got into Tribeca, believe it or not.
That would have been awesome.
I didn't apply though because I knew, like I said, but our foreign distributor had someone and they showed it to him and we almost made it to their midnight screening, but they were like, it's a little too small for us, you know, which is like, hey, I'll take it, you know, I understand.
Yeah. But hey, that's shoot that you were in the conversations. Awesome.
Yeah. Well, if not getting into Fantastic Fest hurt because it was like, man, this is up your alley. How do you not get what this is? You know? So, but hey.
But festivals are like, the festivals are festivals, man. And they all have, look, I'm going to go down that road right now with my new movie, This Is Meg. And you know, it's the first time I'm going through it as a director of a feature film, not a producer of a feature or a director of shorts. So, you can't take it personally, man. It's just like, look, it's the right place, right time, right project, and the right person sees it and says, hey, yeah, let's make that happen. I've seen people get into Sundance that had absolutely no idea that would ever it was a lottery ticket. And then I've had other movies that I'm like, oh, that's a sure in for this festival, and they they don't get in. So yeah, something like Fantastic Fest. I mean, that's a no brainer. But who knows what was going on that day? The programmer who saw it. You know what I mean? It's just rough.
I mean, to their credit, I emailed because I'm cara dura. I don't know how you want to translate that, but
that would be hard headed.
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah. Or you know, thick skinned.
I
emailed them and I'm like, hey, so what is there any feedback? Because I want feedback. You know, you can say no, but it's like I got to know what's going on. And they're very nice, and they you know, they wrote back. I mean, the letter stung even more because he's like, oh, our programmers saw it and they just didn't have fun. They didn't get it. It's like, ow.
Wow. Well, you wanted it. There you go. Yeah, you wanted it.
You know, but then in Florida Supercom to actually see the movie, because you know how that is. You make a movie, you're watching it for like a year by yourself. To actually see it with an audience.
Oh, so much fun.
That justified it because it was exactly the right audience. I mean, they were yelling at the screen. They were telling the kids, don't get out of the car and stuff like that. So, you know, and there's a lot of 80s references that I write off the top of my head. And yes, I'm taking a line from this movie. It's not like I'm trying to sneak it in there. No, it's an homage. And some people won't get it. But this crowd was like, oh, my God, Ferris Bueller, you did it and stuff like that. So they got all the inside jokes.
Yeah. And this is a kind of movie that, you know, in its initial release might not get what you want, or hopefully it will, but then 5 years down the line, all of a sudden you got a cult classic on it because it has the potential for that without question.
Oh yeah. I mean I tell my investors, I don't know how much they this reassures them, but it's like, I know 10 years from now, 20 years from now, we'll be making money in this movie. Are we gonna make any money this year? I don't know, but 10 years from now, I know we'll be making money. And it's just, that's the way it is, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. Now how is it, I want people to understand what it's like producing movies in Miami.
Well, it's good and bad. Like sometimes, and I fault myself here. I don't really like to play with others. So there's people that whenever I go to LA or New York, or even you tell me, hey, do you know this guy? And it's like, I have no idea who that is. And it's like, dude, he's been in the industry. It's like, I do my own thing, you know? And then I don't, you know, Miami isn't really like a film.
No.
Culture. Every it's so hard to get a movie here that it's every man for himself, you know. And then I just put together my crew. I usually go after money myself, and I get people who are not in the industry, because I like that, because they're not going to read the script. The one thing, I mean, I'm a jolly kind of guy, but I have a bad temper, and the one thing that sets me off is when someone that doesn't know film says, hey, can I read the script? It's like you, my producing partner like kicks me under the table. She's like, oh my God, please don't blow up. And it's like, because it's like, I'm going to get Frank Gehry to design this building and then I'm going to ask him to read the blueprints. Do you know anything about blueprints? No. And what the hell are you doing? Have you read a script? No. Shut the fuck up then. You don't need to read the script, you know? The bad side is that then they're, you know, especially in Miami, you know, Miami, what's the only business here is tourism and construction. Construction is how much is the building? When is it going up? When do I get my money? And film is, it's tough. You don't know what to say. You know, you got to be, and the best thing is be honest with them. If you tell them, hey, yeah, right away, you're going to get your money back. That's the wrong way to go, because it's not going to happen.
Yeah.
So, you know, paint a picture, and in your contract, be very specific. There's a line in the contract that says, this is an investment. And there's, you know, in legal speak, but you could lose everything. And that's the truth, you know?
Yeah, you have to. You have to do that. Now, let me ask you a question. With these kind of genre movies, in your experience, how are they being accepted by distributors? Like, I know there was a big run on horror and a big run on sci-fi. You know, are these kind of genre movies still being accepted and actually still being needed in the marketplace?
I think there's fans for them, but the reason I did Shark and Saw in the first place was I saw what sci-fi was doing and buying, and I heard the numbers they were paying. And this is like 3 years ago. They were paying anywhere from $250, $350 to like half a mil or more, because they would give you incentives on ratings, and that just doesn't exist anymore. I mean, and not right now, I'm going through that right now where my domestic sales guy is telling me, you know, people aren't buying. And what's happening is even Netflix, they're investing in creating original content, which is good. But then we're back to having to pitch. And that's what I want to avoid. So really, I'm entering a phase where Attack of the Killer Donuts, I hate to say, might be my last horror comedy. Because I'm really going to go even lower budget, indie. And what I really like I said, is my world is more noir, more that kind of, you know, Reservoir Dogs, not even Pulp Fiction, or Fassbinder, or that sort of – that's where I'm going to go, and it's very realistic. I like – as a director, because I'm a writer, Mm-hmm. That's what I am. And then I'm a producer by nature and director by necessity. and I'm going to direct. And what I like, how I like to direct is very like voyeuristic camera. Mm-hmm. I don't like camera moves. I don't like handheld. I want it to be almost like there's certain Robert Altman movies. If you see a chance to see The Company, see the whole movie and you don't realize, oh man, I just saw a movie. I don't like to be taken out of the experience. I want you to think you're seeing real life. Mm-hmm. So very minimalistic, not too much music. Music is great and it enhances a film, but it's still a film. Mm-hmm. When you see an indie low budget movie and there's no music, man, that's really happening. Mm-hmm. You know?
Yeah.
So that's what I'm going to embrace, and that's what I'm looking at. That and also documentaries. I'm in post production on a documentary right now, and I'm prepping for another one.
They actually sell all the time, and they travel really well, from my understanding.
Yes, big time. That's what's they're cheaper to make, there's a demand for them. You know, and I was lucky to speak to Billy Corbin. That he's the one who did Cocaine Cowboys, and he won mm-hmm. an Emmy for The U, and he's a Miami guy. And again, how did you talk to Billy Corbin? I cold called him.
Yeah.
And he's the kind of guy that he'll answer the phone, you know, and his assistant said, you know, he only has half an hour at this day, this time. And I was like, all right, I'll do it. And he ended up talking to me for over an hour and just, you know, picking his brain. And I was telling him, I want to go into documentaries and what do you recommend and this and that. And he was like, yeah, man, they're selling, you know, Netflix wants them. Everybody wants them. So it's the way to go. And it's for my type of shooting. Like I said, I wasn't trained as a director. I don't think, oh, let's move the camera here. And then
yeah, you're more documentary in general.
I'm already more cinema verite. So I might as well just stick to that. So,
yeah, that's the thing. A lot of people don't understand that, that documentaries are doing really well and have been doing well for a long time. I know guys who've made over $1 million self-distributing their documentaries because of the whole the cause and finding a cause behind the documentary, and then everyone jumps on board.
Look at Adam Carolla did a documentary on Paul Newman, and then he's self-distributing, not because nobody wanted a movie, but he's taking the middleman out of it. Has a million followers on that podcast.
Yep.
He put it up on a thing called VHX.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, of course. I have my stuff on VHX as well.
I love VHX. Mm-hmm. And he's selling directly. So he has a million followers. Mm-hmm. If 10% of his people buy it, that's 100,000.
Yeah,
exactly. Times 14, that's $1.4 million in his pocket. Not to a distributor. You know, you can't beat that.
No, absolutely. And then on top of that, then you can go to Amazon Video directly and start popping it up on there. You can do Vimeo Pro. I mean, there's so many revenue streams now but you need that audience, is what I preach all the time. You need an audience.
That's the key. And then now the Range 15 guys, I don't know if you know about the
– No, I don't.
It's a Range 15 is this movie made by – it's ex-Special Forces guys that they have a clothing line at two separate groups, and they combined and they made this zombie movie. And they have a huge following because it's a loyal fan base. Mm-hmm. And then they went to Indiegogo and they asked for $350,000 and they ended up getting $1 million and change.
Wow.
So, yeah. So then – and what they did is, you know, instead of, hey, we get to make money. No, they threw everything at the screen. So they got William Shatner, Sean Austin, David Keith. I think Danny Trejo might be in it.
Of course.
I'm not sure.
I think if by law, Danny has to be in every movie, I think.
Yeah. So – And they put it in theaters. They used – I don't remember – I'm sorry which one they used, but they used some way where
Tug?
You have to – yeah.
Tug.
There you go. You have to pre-sell certain amount of tickets. Mm-hmm. And if you make it, they'll put it in the theaters. And then now they're self-distributing. And they're using a distributor also.
Yeah, distributor is another awesome. Yeah. I'm actually going to be doing a bunch of stuff with distributor in the future because they're actually cool. They allow you to kill the middleman and you can go directly to – all the online platforms and VOD and cable VOD as well.
Yeah, it's up to you. I mean, there are fees, and it's not their fees. It's, you know, it's not distributor taking their cut. They have a very small fee. It's
very Amazon affordable.
So, but the thing is, like I said before, you have to, as a filmmaker, if you're going to make a movie, look into distributor beforehand and see how much money you're going to need to save for that and tuck that away. So that when your movie is made, you can do it, as opposed to now, hey, I want to be a distributor, I can't afford it, you know. So
right, exactly. And then it's also about just understanding marketing, understanding a distribution plan, understanding all that stuff when you make your movie, and keeping that budget low enough that you can make your money back.
Definitely. I mean, I think the budgets are going to get lower and lower. Donuts was under 500,000. We shot Shark and Saw for under 300,000, if you can believe that. And I think the budgets are going lower than that. I mean, again, depending on what you get, you know, you throw money at me, I'll make a movie. It doesn't matter how much money. You can't make the same movie for the same amount of money. You almost have to be like food, like deconstructed. It's like, okay, we only have 150,000. Can we make a movie? Yes. There's not going to be any stars in it. And what do we have? What are our assets? Well, I got three blank guns, a bikini model. My friend has a Ferrari. You know, so you just start to, what do we got? And that's what the movie is.
Yeah, you go down the Robert Rodriguez way of, and mariachi way of doing things, which is like, what do you have? Let's write a script around all your assets.
Exactly.
And that's the smartest way of going about it. That's what I did with Meg. I literally just looked around. I'm like, all right. I have access to these, this, 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 and this. That's what we're making our movie about. And let's go. Now, let me ask you, from your experience in distribution, as far as foreign sales are concerned, are there specific countries that like genre movies more, less? You know, can you tell us any stories from the distribution, worldwide distribution experiences that you've had?
Unfortunately, everybody wants names now. Okay. So if you make a no names movie, even this genre, it's hard. Mm-hmm. Japan always likes monster movies. Germany loves anything American. They're very kind. And ironically, of course, the two territories we've already sold is Germany and Japan. Mm-hmm. So,
but they're both very big markets.
Yeah, in the big picture, yeah. Yeah. And then there's we're an English-speaking movie, so England is always going to be big. But then the other ones, it's kind of tough. It depends how much – again, if it was a straight horror slasher movie, I think it would maybe have more legs if it had a nudity. But this is horror comedy, so, you know.
Which is always a tough sell in general.
Yes, it is very, very. People are like, why are you doing that? And it's like, well, that's just what we're doing here. So so that's where it's a little slow coming. And then it's almost like, does domestic, you know, if you make it big in domestic, then does that turn into foreign? But believe it or not, more and more the domestic market, USA and foreign, it's splitting. It's a road and they're not meeting. And it's just totally different. Like there's movies that are bombing here and they're rocking in China. And then it's like, what's more important?
You know? Well, like Warcraft. Warcraft was an absolute bomb here, but overseas it killed.
Yeah, and not only genre movies, but sometimes, you know, the more dramas, stuff like that's a nightmare to sell here. But they're into that in foreign. And something that I like, and it comes from my Lion Video days, is I love foreign movies, so I know these actors. It's like, oh, I recognize this guy, I recognize that guy. And if you have an opportunity, again, it all depends on cost, but this one guy, let's say you're doing a movie and it's the chef. Mm-hmm. Instead of just putting a no-name chef, if you can get this guy who's in Germany, but he hasn't made an American movie, now when you go sell it, hey, Germany might be a little bit more interested.
And they could give you a lot because he's a big German star.
Exactly. Or this person who's – and again, remember, everybody wants to play here. Like in Miami, the big thing is there's telenovela stars left and right that want to break into the market. You know, again, unfortunately, Latin America is not so big as in Europe and other countries, but it's still, hey.
It's still money.
Now, exactly. And I got so-and-so in this. You know, and a lot of these telenovela stars are like me and you. They were born here, so they have zero accent. So
yeah,
know,
I did a movie with Kate del Castillo, and Eva Longoria, and they sold it in South America, huge, because Kate del Castillo, before the whole El Chapo thing, no one knew her really as much here in the States, but she's a monster over in South America.
Yeah, and even here in some in the States domestically for some markets, like there's a story of, I don't know if you know who Carlos Ponce is.
I know Carlos, actually never worked with him, but I've met him a couple times. He's awesome,
nicest guy in the world. He was in for people who are out there, he was in Couples Retreat. The shredded guy in the Speedos with the accent.
He was also on that Cristela TV show. Yes. He starred in that as well. Super sweet guy.
And he says a story once that he went with, I don't remember what big time actor, and they were in LA and they're having lunch or whatever. And somehow they went to a restaurant, and who works in the back of the restaurant? You know, somebody took a peek and they're like, oh my God, Carlos Ponce. And the entire kitchen comes out and they're like, can we take a picture? And the guy, the actor he's with, thinks it's with him. And that guy hands him the camera and is like, no, with Carlos. And then
that's brilliant.
So they take a picture and then they go back. And I forgot who the name of the actor is. He tells Carlos, "Hey, dude, who the hell are you?" He's like, "Hey, man, I'm big.
I'm huge, just not yeah. right here, but huge.
I'm big in the kitchen."
Yeah, Carlos is he's Cubano también, right?
He's Cuban parents, born in Puerto Rico.
Oh, okay, Cuban parents born in Puerto Rico. So,
and he's excellent at accents in Spanish or English. Like mm-hmm. in Spanish, man, he'll go from neutral to Cuban, to Mexican, to Argentinian, to it's like boom, 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 boom. He's really good.
He works all the time too. He's one of those guys that works all the time. And he was born with ridiculously good looks.
Right?
Like absurdly good looks for a man. It's ridiculous. So let me ask you one, like if you had one, if you had a classroom of fresh eyed, wondered, like sparkly eyes, I want to be in Hollywood kind of film students. What would you say to them before they got launched into a film career?
Right now, what I would tell them is shoot, shoot, shoot. Always be shooting. If you wait for this script is too good, I can't do it now, you blink and 10 years pass by and you haven't done anything. Mm-hmm. You know, I just this last weekend, Jonas Trueba was in town and he spoke. He's a director and his father is Fernando Trueba, who won the Oscar for Best Foreign Film for Belle Epoque. And he's like in his 20s and he's making movies now. He's made 4 movies. And this is a man who has a name in Europe. I mean, he can get people to give him money. And one of the movies he did took him 7 months because he was trying to get funding and he got tired of that. And he's like, you know what? I'm going to get together with a group of people, my core keys, which is 6 people, and we're going to shoot for free. And we're going to shoot one day for 6 hours. And I don't know when we'll shoot again, but this day we'll shoot for 6 hours. And he did that for 7 months, 22 shooting days, and he got a movie. Now, if I tell you, let's make a movie in 7 months, that's a nightmare.
Oh, my God. Can you imagine? It's just – you just have to – what's the endurance that you have to just keep that momentum going? Oh.
But the flip side is it's September now, and what have I shot this year? Nothing. If I would have done the same thing starting in January and said, I'm going to one day a week, just one day a week, we're going to shoot something for free. What would I have by now? You know, and to students who don't have money, who don't have the, you know, if you're a student still in school, you have an arsenal of equipment at your disposal. I mean, University of Miami has, you know, some of the movies I've shot, that's how I shot it because my DP worked for UM. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, if you're young and you have that, you know, shoot, always be shooting and don't be afraid to shoot something that's not as good. That's what being in your 20s and being in film school is all about.
Mm-hmm.
You know, experiment now. That's the problem with film, I think, in general, that, you know, Picasso didn't wake up when he was 12 and said, hey, cubism. No, he was classically trained and it took him years to get to that. As filmmakers, we don't get an opportunity to experiment and to grow because everything has to be a hit and it's too much money and that's too bad, you know. I think we need that.
And that's the thing that I actually mentioned before is on the show as well, is that I use the analogy of baseball, where anytime you walk up to the plate, filmmakers think they have to hit a home run. But they only go up to the plate once every 2 or 3 years. But those guys that go up all the time, and you know what? They might be singles. But every single gets you closer to that home run. And you just got to get up to the plate. And by getting up to the plate, you just got to keep shooting. Got to keep making. And don't worry. If it doesn't turn out great, all right, you've learned and you move on. And that's something that it takes years. And, you know, you and I are both from the same vintage. I think that's something you learn with age. You know, I'm in my 20s, I couldn't even fathom that. But it's something that as you get older, you're just like, you know what? What's the worst that will happen? You make a movie that doesn't do everything you want it to do, but it's okay. You made a mistake. Every one of these big directors all made mistakes. Every one of them. And they learn from them.
And it's getting to you. It's getting you to where you want to go. It's getting you to that point. Look at Mark Duplass. He said it.
Oh,
he's like, you know, he should be the inspiration for everybody out there.
Yep.
And that speech he said at South by Southwest 2 years ago, where he said the Calvary is not coming. Those days of you're going to Sundance and going to write your check for $3 million are not going to happen. Nope. And he knew that. So what he was is instead of being good, I'm going to be prolific.
Yeah, and
he went him and Swanberg.
Yeah, Joe Swanberg, Lynn Shelton, that whole crew, right?
That Mumblecore group, they were cranking out, you know, 3-4. Sometimes Swanberg did 5 movies in 1 year.
1 year he did 7. That was his record. Wow. He's a crazy man.
But it's feature films again. You know, I'm sometimes I'm a little harsh on people who do shorts.
Yeah,
but it's because a feature film is something you could sell. It's real. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm not saying I'm not knocking shorts. If you do a short, that's great. You know, you're still shooting. Mm-hmm. But you do a Swamberger, a Duplass, and you crank that for 5 years. Let's say four movies for 5 years. Hey, after 5 years, you got 20 feature films under your belt.
Someone's
going to take notice. Yeah.
No, that's the thing. And that's what Swansburg said. Like, it took him, I think, probably about four or five features shooting on VHS, like, you know, on mini DVs and stuff like that. They didn't care about sound. They didn't. That whole mumblecore movement is kind of the inspiration for what I did with Meg, but at a, hopefully at a higher production quality than they did when they first started. But the technology now, you could just go out and shoot, man. You just go out and shoot. It's crazy, man. It really is crazy. But that's great advice.
I'll go now. Well, and as a matter of fact, there's 10 to 20 film festivals around the world specifically only for stuff you shoot with an iPhone or with your phone. So that's, you know, oh, I don't have a camera, I don't have money. You got a phone? They sell lenses, a lens, little mini lens package for phones for like $40. So there's no excuse, you know.
No.
It's not going to be pretty, but it's something.
Well, I mean, look at Tangerine, and I use Tangerine all the time, which Sean Baker did, who won Sundance, shot on that iPhone. But a lot of people thought that, like, oh, now I can go shoot a movie with an iPhone. I'm like, well, if you want it to look like Tangerine, you really got to do your homework and understand what he did. But you can do it. He did it. You can do it. If, as long as it works for the story that you're trying to tell. If you're trying to make Transformers, the iPhone might be rough. But if you're making a character piece, it's fine. It's great. It's absolutely great. So, my friend, I asked the same questions of all of my guests. I have the last two questions. What is the lesson that took you the longest to learn, whether in the film business or in life?
To just do it. Like I said, I've spoken to agents in CAA. I've spoken to Billy Corbin. I've spoken to other people, and I just picked up the phone and cold called. The worst that can happen is no. And also just to be persistent. My favorite word is relentless. I won't stop. One investor that invested in one of my films, I would email him in the morning and call him at night every day for 9 days straight, including Sunday. And one day he's like, we have to meet. You're driving me crazy. And I'm like, good. Because if you don't say no, I'm coming after you.
If he would have said no, you would have stopped.
If he says no, yes, I would have stopped. Unless I feel like maybe there's just a little bit more. But yeah, you got to say a hard no.
Yeah, because sometimes no really means maybe.
Yeah.
Now, what are three of your favorite films of all time?
Oh, this is such a difficult question because there's so many good ones.
I know. But three that tickle your fancy today, sir.
There's something you just have to mention. I mean, my all-time favorite is Casablanca.
I love Casablanca, man.
There's midgets in the background and it's a miniature and they did so much with so little. Think about it. There's no sex in it. I mean, it took me years to figure out, oh, Rick did sleep with her, but I didn't, you know, it's so subtle. I didn't know that, but it's such a great movie. And I don't know if we have those kind of decisions or that kind of like love and a cause now. Is there a cause you would really do that for? Hell no. So Casablanca, definitely number one. More modern, Godfather. I mean, that's just perfect movie, you know.
It's a masterpiece, yeah.
Yeah. And then, God, I got to go eclectic because I love like foreign films and stuff like that. So I think I almost got to go Breathless by Jean-Luc Godard.
Oh, it's a great film, man.
And the thing is, it's a flawed film and it's not perfect. No. And people see it now, sometimes younger people, and they're like, I don't get it. I'm like, you know what? Go watch another French movie from 1959 or like Pillow Talk from 1959 where it's like they're in separate beds and it's this polished turd, where Breathless is so real. And it's if you watch that movie and it doesn't inspire you to go out and shoot something, you're not a filmmaker.
To make a point to that, and again, since you and I are both of the same vintage, and I wanted to ask you this, this has happened to me, where when you see something when you're in your teens or 20s and you don't get it, but in your 30s, you might start feeling a little bit, but maybe in your 40s, I'm not saying you're in your 40s, but
I'm 42.
Okay. Same. So you're the exact same vintage as I am. So now you're in your early 40s and you watch a movie like Eyes Wide Shut, where when it came out in 99, you might have gone, I get it, but I don't get it. Or you watch Clockwork Orange, or you watch, I'm just using Stanley Kubrick references, but those kind of movies that, you know, that age well, and they age. Like, in other words, like, great art should change as you grow. So looking at the Mona Lisa when you're 15 should be a lot different than when you look at it when you're in your 50s. Different appreciation, different kind of, you know, connoisseur of the art. Yeah, have you had movies like that?
Yeah, and also taking, like I said, things in context. Like, for example, there's some younger guys now that see Pulp Fiction, they're like, it's all right. I say, yeah, it's all right because it's been so redone afterwards.
Like The Godfather.
Put it in 1994 and you're like, wow. Like Breathless, 1959, you're like, whoa. You know, I mean, certain things like Coming Home. Hal Hartley in 19, I don't remember if it was 69, 70, around mm-hmm. there. I mean, let's put this into perspective. There's a scene where, what's Angelina Jolie's dad's name?
John Voight.
John Voight, yeah. John Voight is eating out Jane Fonda. I mean, let me repeat that. He's performing oral sex on Jane Fonda. This is an R-rated movie in the cinema, nominated for Best Picture. Mm-hmm. I think he won Best Actor for that. Now fast forward to 2016. You can't put a freaking boob on TV. I mean, in the movies. Like, how is that possible that we've regressed so much? You know, but definitely what you said. Some movies age better. Like back in '94, again, Pulp Fiction, Forrest Gump. I mean, I was in the Pulp Fiction camp all the way.
Mm-hmm.
Now you ask me which is the best one, and you know what? It might be Shawshank Redemption. It might be the third movie nobody talks about.
Oh, no, it is Shawshank. I mean, don't get me wrong. Like, let's not talk about if Pulp Fiction is better than Forrest or better than Shawshank, but Shawshank is one of those movies that holds and will hold for eternity. While I think Pulp Fiction, you're right, it was of that moment, and it was a nuclear bomb that went off. While Shawshank was not that nuclear bomb, he was the tortoise.
Yeah.
And that tortoise has been slowly to now on IMDb, it's ranked higher than Godfather as the best movie of all time. Wow. And a lot of people put it up there with the freaking Godfather because it is. It's one of those movies that you just watch and just go, okay, this is as perfect of a movie as you can get, from my opinion. You know, and yeah. I think I'm not alone on that. But yeah, that definitely happens. From our time, you know, I thought Bloodsport was the greatest movie of all time when I saw it. Now, don't get me wrong, Bloodsport freaking rocks, man.
That's the flip side of it. Like, I love Bloodsport, but how many movies are there that you remember as a kid and it's like, this movie's awesome, and you see it now and it's heartbreaking. It's like, oh my God, it's so bad.
I mean, Hard to Kill. I'm going to go down the Steven Seagal, Jean-Claude Van Damme camp. All of those movies, when they came out, I was just like, this is double impact. This is awesome. This is great. And then you're like, oh, like, I remember when that you watch it like it's on TNT or something as you're, you know, watching one night, and you're like, ouch, that doesn't hold. That doesn't hold well.
To the pop-up is Flash Gordon. You remember the
Flash Gordon? Jesus, man, Flash Gordon. That did not age well at all.
And Crawl. Oh, my God.
Oh, my God, Crawl. Like, I still only remember it being the most awesome movie of all time when I saw
it.
I'm never going to watch it. And Liam Neeson was in that.
Was he?
Liam Neeson, a young Liam Neeson, was one of the, like, sub characters. Like, he's one of, like, the co-stars of that movie, if you go back. But yeah, Crawl, for anyone who does, I'm going to put links of the description to these films in the show notes, guys, because Crawl arguably was the greatest movie of all time when it came out. Like, it was just like absolutely amazing. I remember.
Actually, speaking of Liam Neeson, I have the Miami Vice episode he was in.
Oh, yeah. Anyone, like, if you guys watch Miami Vice, anyone listening, everybody who's a big star walked through the Miami Vice doors. For those three, I'm like, everybody, Bruce Willis, Helen Bonham Carter, Liam Neeson, and then there's thousands of names that I just don't remember off the top of my head. But Phil Collins. There was a movie, I'm going to geek out for a second. Do you remember watching a movie called Showdown in Little Tokyo?
Oof. Don't tell me. That is Dolph Lundgren.
Yep.
And Bruce Lee's Brandon Lee.
The late Brandon Lee, yes.
Yeah.
Greatest action movie I had ever seen at that point. I literally remember watching it. Stopped it at the end of the VHS, rewound it, watched it again. It was just like such a great film. And I've seen it lately. And you know, it's campy now. Now it's just like, oh, that's kind of nostalgic campy. It holds better, surprisingly, than a lot of 80s action movies.
Well, I mean, if we're going to geek out, I'm going to go in the martial arts route.
Oh, let's go. Gymkhana? Gymkhana?
No, that one's bad. No, a Showdown in Little Tokyo. What I'm saying is, if you really want to see authentic Jeet Kune Do, which is the form Bruce Lee developed, Showdown Little Tokyo is probably, I don't know if they've done something after that, but that was the best example of Jeet Kune Do, because what Brandon Lee is doing is Jeet Kune Do. And if you don't know martial arts, it's very subtle, it doesn't go over your head, but it's a lot of like front lead, a lot of like, the name of Jeet Kune Do means the way of the intercepting fist. Mm-hmm. So the whole concept was not the traditional kung fu master, which is like, whoa, and a lot of moves. It was just more direct. But if you're a martial arts enthusiast and you want to see real Jeet Kune Do, that's where it peaked right there.
Did he do it in rapid fire as well?
He did. Yeah. Anything that has Brandon Lee, he did that. That was
he only had a few movies.
Yeah.
And The Crow, of course. Whoever's not seen The Crow, the original. I know they're talking about remaking it, but they shouldn't. The first one was brilliant.
Why? Why do they make remakes? I mean,
don't get me started. I mean, MacGyver, the new show. Come on. Lethal Weapon, a show. Really?
I don't get that.
Come on.
I don't get that.
Come on. Sorry. Sorry, guys. We have gone off the rails. We've just started to geek out a bit.
Well, before we go, another movie I have to recommend. P.T. Anderson.
Mm-hmm. Of course.
People love him. I mean, Paul Thomas Anderson, he has a lot of great movies. Go see Hard Eight, his first movie.
Oh, yeah.
That's my favorite movie of his. I own it, and I'll pop it in. I've seen that movie like 12 times because it's so subtle, and it's so how to make a good small movie. Yes, mm-hmm. Gwyneth Paltrow's in it, and they have some names in it, and Samuel Jackson, whatever. But look at the filming. Look at the shots. And a lot of times, another advice that I give out, when I really want to see shots in a movie, I'll watch a movie in mute.
Yep.
Because then you're not following the story. It's just visually. Like I saw with my wife, I went to the movies to see what is this movie? Scott. The movie with Michael Fassbender that he's an attorney. Penelope Cruz, The Counselor.
Oh, The Counselor.
Do you remember The Counselor? Mm-hmm.
That was a Ridley Scott movie, wasn't it?
Yes, Ridley Scott. It was such a mess. My wife leaned into me and said, "Do you understand what's going on?" And I whispered and I said, "No, but look how pretty it is." It was like, and I told
her, it's Ridley.
Yeah. When this comes out on DVD, yeah, I'm so going to watch this in mute and really enjoy it, because it was just – the script was just a mess. I'm like, what is going on? I don't get it. But there's a scene when he sees the Mexican lawyer. It's a Rembrandt. I mean, what he does with lighting is fantastic.
No, I mean, but Ridley Scott, I mean, he's a living legend, and I hope he continues to make – there's a few directors that I hope that are with us, like Clint Eastwood. I hope he's with us for a while longer. Because every time he does something, it's just, for the most part, he always does amazing stuff. Ridley is one of those guys. Spielberg, of course. Though I heard BFG was a little off.
I hate to say, we were on such a good note. I don't want to be a hater, but I've never been a real Spielberg fan.
All right, so that'll be the end of the episode, guys. Thank you so much. No, I'm joking. No, no, it happened. No, it's all good. It's all good.
He's a great filmmaker, because what he does good is when he wants you to cry, you're going to cry. When he wants you to jump, you're going to jump. He is a good filmmaker. Mm-hmm. I just don't like his style. That's all it is. Like, for example, like what I was saying, like when I film, I don't want you to know I'm there and move my camera around. He always has to have a little something where he lets you know, hey, I'm here. Like, for example, this is a big pet peeve of mine. Catch Me If You Can. Mm-hmm. Great movie. Leonardo DiCaprio.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
The big climactic scene. He's packing the money in the second store and they're going to run out. And that money floats away, where you had to do that with CGI, because money doesn't do that. And it's like, why did you do that? Why are you taking me away from the film? Mm-hmm. But in his defense.
But the style.
No, I mean, that's just taste,
Sure.
In his defense, if you see Munich, which is a dark film, it's very not like Steven Spielberg. It's just shot incredibly. That's an incredible movie too. And it's really dark.
Yeah. And Jaws, of course, is still.
Yeah. Jaws, again, it's the perfect. You're not going to see the monster and you're still going to be very scared and you're going to jump when I tell you to jump. He's great at that. Credit where credit is due.
And Jaws holds. I mean, for movies, there's not a lot of movies from the 70s that hold today.
Well, it depends. I mean, there's a lot of like the 70s was the golden age of like this is you're talking late 70s when we
Taxi Driver, Easy Rider, those things. But like just like the effect, like Pulp Fiction was a very specific movie in the 90s that kind of blew up. And there's like Taxi Driver still holds very well. These are masterpieces. Obviously, all of the Godfathers in the 70s. But Jaws as a horror movie, like how many thriller horror movies from the 70s hold today? You know, it's a very short, very short list.
Yeah, they're not that good.
Yeah, something that just would still, like, if I pop that in, it'll still scare the hell out of you. And it's just done so well. So well. But anyway, we have gone completely off the rails. no worries, man. So, Ravel, where can people find you online?
Well, Twitter and Instagram, it's Rafa Miami, RafaMiami. Mm-hmm. Rafa Miami. And then that's pretty much what I put out there. It's I try to keep it either very positive, filmic. I don't get into politics or anything like that. So, or just everyday life. Like there's an Instagram, a can of jupina that I'm drinking or stuff like that. And then Attack of the Killer Donuts, we're going to conclude our festival run and hopefully be available by the end of the year. If not December, January, around that time, and probably at one point a VHX, because I love VHX. I can't talk enough about them.
No, VHX is a great again. If you have that, it's a great platform. If you have an audience, and if you can drive traffic, it's. I mean, I would if I can send a million people to VHX, I would self distribute everything.
Oh yeah, oh yeah. There's not even a million. And that's another thing. Like, before we go, like a good point to put out there of you got to build your audience. And really, in this day and age, what you need is 10,000 true fans. There's a business term for that.
That's actually 1,000 true fans.
Oh, there you go.
It's based on the article from the founder of Wired magazine. It's 1,000 true fans. 1,000 true fans that could pay you $10 a month. $100 a year. $100 a year.
Whether it's one thing for 100 or 10 for 10, because then it's 100,000. Mm-hmm. I say 10,000 because then you start flirting with that. You know, 10% million. Yeah.
Yeah.
Right, so, you got to get them out there because there's models that have millions of followers on Instagram, and I used one of them for a project, and I'm like, well, 10% of her followers, and it's like that doesn't translate. You have to have true fans. True fans are
exactly just because you're a beautiful girl on Instagram and you have 3 million followers. Like I was talking to somebody the other day about it. Like if you put Kim Kardashian in a movie, that doesn't mean anything.
Yeah, it doesn't.
She has 77 million followers on Instagram and Twitter and all that stuff. Doesn't mean a thing. You know, it doesn't. It really doesn't mean a thing. So it's about true fans, people who really, really care about what you're doing as an artist or as a company, depending. So, my friend, I won't take up any more of your time, brother. Thank you so much for being on The Hustle, man. Thanks so much.
No, thank you. And I look forward to seeing you in LA in person. I'll probably be there for AFM in November. So,
all right. Sounds good, brother. We'll see you soon.
Cool. Bye-bye.
I want to thank Rafael for coming on the show and sharing his knowledge about Killer Donuts, for God's sakes. The one thing I love about this story and about this film is that they know their audience. They understood their niche audience. And instead of going after a generalized horror movie, they went after a sub-niche of the niche. Actually, it's like a sub-niche of a sub-niche. And it's small, but if you keep the budget low, it makes sense. So this is a very good example of that. And the movie's not for everybody, but it's not built for everybody. It's built for people who love this kind of film. So again, when you're thinking about making a film, niche down. Don't go to a wide audience. Don't try to, at the indie level, don't try to do a wide audience. Try to niche down as much as possible. And I think they have a lot of opportunity to make more money with ancillary products and tour horror conventions and stuff like that. So let's see what happens with the movie. But it's been out for a couple years, and I know they're still doing their thing with it. And it's definitely gotten a lot of attention over the years as well. So thank you, Rafael, for coming on the show. If you want the show notes and want to watch this movie, head over to the show notes at filmtrepreneur.com/035. And if you haven't already, please, 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 head over to filmbizpodcast.com. That's filmbizpodcast.com. Leave us a review on iTunes. It really, really helps us out a lot. I want to get this information out to as many filmmakers as possible. Now, guys, one last thing before we go. This week, I released an episode called an ex-distributor employee speaks out, which was, his name is Neil Ames. And I didn't release it on this podcast, but I did release it on Indie Film Hustle. And I do have it on the Filmtrepreneur website as a kind of bonus post blog. But if you want to listen to that and really understand what happened on the inside of the distributor debacle and listen to how Neil, you know, kind of talks about his experience there and how, why he didn't help filmmakers, why didn't he call out, why didn't he say something publicly until now, and also why he opened up a new film aggregation business. So it's a really great interview if you want to get into what happened with Distribber, and there's some knowledge bombs in there as well. So you can head over to indiefilmhustle.com/375 if you want to check that out. Thank you guys again for listening so much. I truly, truly appreciate it. As always, be a filmtrepreneur. I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks for listening to the Filmtrepreneur podcast at filmtrepreneur.com.